Raymond M. Binkowski is not a physician or registered dietitian. The contents of this should not be taken as medical advice. It's not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any health problem, nor is it intended to replace the advice of a physician. Always consult your physician or qualified health professional on any matters regarding your health. If you're interested in learning more about the content in this podcast, webinar, or episode, click the link in the description or comments to learn more.
All right, Raymond. So we're here today to talk about health, wellness, and being middle-aged. So I'm excited to talk to you because I happen to be middle-aged myself. And I know a lot of people that really struggle with the amount of information, who to believe, where to question things, and who you trust, really. So I think you're going to be an amazing advocate for that. I'm excited to talk to you.
Awesome. Looking forward to it.
Good. So we're going to talk a lot about what's real and what's not. Start us off with, let's talk about long-term weight loss or maintaining a healthy weight for those that are in a good place and want to stay there, or those that would like to lose some. What strategies do you recommend? What is sustainable, really?
So I think it really starts with sustainable. And before we chat sustainable, middle age, we probably need to define in experience. I think middle age starts around 30, and it doesn't have so much to do with your chronological age as it does around age 30. Most individuals are starting to acquire adult responsibilities, mortgage, car payments, kids, illness, death, career changes, layoffs. So those things start happening around age 30, and that's when life really starts to become difficult or challenging. And when we look at long-term success with health, wellness, and weight loss, in over the last almost 25 years of working with people, what I can tell you is that if you do things correctly, you will get health, you will get wellness, and you'll get weight loss. So what that means is all the markers for disease and illness will improve. You'll be happy and you'll be comfortable with how you look in any articles of clothing, or maybe no clothing at all, right? Because you'll be healthy, you'll be well, and you'll lose weight. Now, tying that back to sustainable, that's probably the greatest opportunity for most people is, you know, what your approach is to accomplish that long-term goal. And the reality of it is a long-term goal. You know, your health in losing weight, losing pounds and inches, it's a long-term play. It's not something you want to lose weight to go on that 1 week vacation. Like, who wants to come home from vacation and gain the weight back? So really, sustainability is one of the most important aspects that people should be looking for.
Absolutely. So talk to me about strategies then. What do you recommend to someone that has hit a wall, they're ready for change? Where do they get started?
So the first thing back to sustainability is, as you are looking at long-term success, you need to ask yourself, whatever you're going to do, and I'm biased, and I'm going to share from experience what actually works. But removing that, when you look at things, you have to ask yourself, can I do this long-term? Can I do this only until I go on vacation, only until the wedding, only until the birthday, only until whatever? Or can I really stick with this long-term? And that's really important. And case in point, if you look at pop culture and you look at all of the approaches to losing weight and how many of them have come and gone and how many of them are cyclical. Like, I've been doing this long enough to have seen Atkins come and go, to have seen ketogenic diets, or what people call keto, come and go. How about the 21-day fix? Or how about the wraps, where people were selling wraps where you'd wrap yourself, or the cryo chambers for weight loss, or low-fat diets, which didn't work in the 90s and got abandoned. So really, you need to start thinking, like, if I do this, is it only going to be something I can do until this date, or can I do it long-term?
Okay. So name some of the popular fad diets right now, and what are the common threads why they're not going to work for most people?
So intermittent fasting, it's not necessary. That would be one example. And You know, I can tell you that I lost over 60 pounds, have kept most of it off since the mid 1990s. I'm sitting here about 50 years of age. So I've kept it off most of my adult life, and I never had to do intermittent fasting. So that would be an example. And there can be cases made for some maybe health wellness benefits to long-term fasting for a fast longer than 12 hours. But I don't think it's something that's really sustainable long-term. So that would be example. Only eating proteins and fats, currently popularized by like the carnivore diet. And again, not to argue that I don't doubt there's people that when they eliminate carbohydrates completely, that their joints feel better. And there's a conversation we can have around that. But again, the carnivore diet, you only eat meat. So how long is it going to be appealing to have steak for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and anytime you're hungry? Now, and I understand the carnivore diet has allowances for things beyond steak, but that's just an example. And when we line that up, lean that up against, put that to the sustainability test, can I do that the rest of my life? The answer is going to be no. Those would be two examples. No carb diets, or a lot of people call ketogenic what most call a keto diet or a ketogenic diet. So ketogenic diets are, if they are a legitimate ketogenic diet, they are extremely high in fat. So what does that mean? It means that the percent of calories that come from dietary fat is going to be upwards of 80 or 85%. And then 10% protein and 5% carbohydrates. Most people think they're doing a ketogenic diet. What they're eating is a high protein, moderate fat, low carb diet. But when you start looking at somebody that's going to eat north of 80% of their calories from fat, you're literally having a lot of oils and things like that. It's not like you're eating bacon, which you certainly could, but a lot of like the animal protein and fat sources, they're going to be too high in protein. And the problem with a keto, if you're going to be true to a ketogenic diet, if you eat too much protein, you will struggle to get into ketosis. And I'm sure people are going to listen to this and say it's not true and whatever. For the most part, you will struggle to get in and stay in ketosis. So you have to eat that much fat. And again, back to the sustainability, who wants to, like, do you want to be having tablespoons of oil or tablespoons of MCT oil or tablespoons of butter? It sounds great when you're not eating a lot of that stuff or you don't have a lot of butter, until you're eating tablespoons of butter every day or having to have tablespoons of oil. And there's things like leaky gut happen. Like, it's not there. There's other things that will start to happen when you eat that much fat. But again, most people think they're doing a ketogenic diet. And what they're really doing is a high protein, moderate fat, low carb diet. But to eat north of 80% of your calories from fat is difficult, and it's very difficult to do day in and day out. And it's certainly a challenge to do long term.
Okay. So you've obviously helped hundreds of people at this point to lose weight and keep it off. And there's a lot of personalization in that, and a lot of you really wanting to understand the person in front of you. But what are some of the really big key components of, we've talked about what not to do, what do you tell people to do then? What can apply to almost everyone?
So the biggest thing is you're going to have to weight train 18 or 80. You're not going to get to skip that. You have to carve out time to lift weights. And you know, it's funny. And for those listening to this, you don't know this, but Kelsey Sobel is interviewing me, and Kelsey worked for me in a large commercial health club and hybrid training center. And you saw this in there. We had something called Evolution Platinum, where the average age was about 70 years of age. And the individuals in Evolution Platinum were squatting and deadlifting and flipping tractor tires and pulling sleds and pushing sleds and swinging kettlebells and doing all of the things with weights that we would, you know, stereotype the upper middle age populations and say, you shouldn't do that. It's not safe. Well, nothing can be further from the truth. So long-term resistance training needs to be made a priority. Everybody needs to do resistance training. You need to do it long term. It's a must do. It's not an option. And there's been research done on elderly populations in dependent living situations. So they live in a retirement home or community where they can't independently live. That's why it's dependent. So they require the care of others to do daily activities. Well, by using a Nautilus style program, which is one set per body part, like 5 to 7 exercises every 4 or 5 days, so about once a week, 70% of individuals in dependent living are able to move to independent living. So that's kind of an extreme example, but that's quality of life. And that, you know, if given the choice, would you rather have to have somebody care for you and help you do life's basic activities, or would you rather be able to independently do it? So weight training's a must. Finding something that's active that you enjoy, right? So, you know, Kelsey, you were a college athlete at age 22 or 23, you're done with your eligibility for collegiate athletics. That doesn't mean that you have to stop being active, right? Like, why not continue to play volleyball? Mm-hmm. Why not continue to play basketball? Why not continue to play baseball or softball, right? So find those activities that you did as a kid and continue to do them, because we consider those things games and people enjoy playing games. And I'll give you an example of this. At one point I was working with a local municipal fire department. So the entire fire department, I spent a week at their main firehouse. I interacted with every firefighter that was interested in doing so. I did talks, presentations, seminars, all of this stuff. And I kept having these, I'll say, upper middle-aged firefighters in their 40s and 50s come in and tell me that they were in the best shape of their life when they were allowed to go to a local park district in their city and play basketball on shift or play volleyball. I'm like, really? And I'm like, okay. And they're like, yeah. And there was some gym equipment there, so I did some of that too. And even on my days off, you know, I work 24, I'm off 48. Even on my days off, I often would come over and meet whoever from the department was there to play that day and then do some exercise, whatever, and go home. And I said, well, every firehouse in the city has a gym. Why don't you work out? And they're like, I got the same answer over and over. I don't like working out. I'm like, well, you just told me you would go to the gym on your days off. And now you're telling me at work where you're getting paid to do it, you got to be here anyways. You don't like working out. And they're like, yeah, but that's different. Well, what that underscored was, to the point I just made, people like playing games. They like, for the most part, being around other individuals. They like that team environment. They like the competition. And because of that, they're more inclined to do it even on their days off. So for people that are, you know, over the age of 30, just because you're not in college anymore doesn't mean athletics are done. Find something physically active and do it. It could be rock climbing. It could be doing 5Ks. It could be cycling. It could be rowing. Anything, but find something active and get out there and do it. And then ideally, find something that's going to take you out of your comfort zone. Find a physical activity that you're not accustomed to doing, and force yourself to stretch, force yourself to get uncomfortable, force yourself to put yourself out there, maybe be a bit vulnerable, know you're going to fail, and go and have that experience, especially for the people that have kids. I think that's powerful in showing your kids that, one, life in physical activity after the age of 30 doesn't have to end. And two, it teaches them that it, in like, you know, it's normal in life to be uncomfortable and have to face obstacles and keep pushing forward. Mm-hmm. Those would probably be the two biggest things with activity. And then the next one's food. And, you know, part of what I do today is, a large part is prep competitors that want to compete in bodybuilding and physique contests. And believe it or not, you can get very lean and get on the competitive stage enjoying the foods you like. So you can still have pizza. You can still have pasta. You can still have chips. You can still have a glass of wine or whatever it might be. The key is approaching your nutrition as you know, I teach it as four targets. You have a calorie, carb, protein, and fat target. Some people recognize that as macros, whatever, it doesn't matter. And then finding foods you like to hit those four targets. And don't make it any more complicated than that.
That's awesome. Do you remember one of my first shows that you helped prep me for? I had Portillo's.
Yes.
And you weren't even mad at me. And you were like, you actually look better today.
Yeah, we're not meant to be miserable. We're not meant to live in a box. And when it comes to food, that's part of the reason these other approaches that are short term don't work, right? It's like if you take somebody and you put them in a box, the first thing you're going to try and do is jump out of the box. So how do I apply that to food? If you tell somebody they can't have carbohydrates, they'll do it for a little while, but then eventually they're starting to want carbohydrates. They start wanting what they were told they can't have. If somebody's only going to eat steak, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it sounds super cool and exciting, but at some point they're going to want something other than steak. Like they want to get out of that steak box. If you tell somebody they can eat all the bacon they want and they can put butter in their coffee or heavy cream in their coffee, that's cool for a little while, but then pretty soon they want to get out of that box. So you really, if you're going to be successful, the food has to be something you can do long term, and it has to include the food you're actually going to want to eat.
You're making it a choice for people too. I feel like that you want that autonomy, and that's when you start really digging into the psychology of it, right? And all those short-term things, they're deprivation. It's no, 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 no. And I think that takes a psychological toll too.
100%. That's exactly, in my experience, that seems to be exactly what happens. Once they've told themselves no long enough, they're like, the hell with it. Like, I got to have this. It's no different than kids that, you know, grow up and are told to never have alcohol. And now they're 18. They're not legally allowed to drink, but they go away to college. Not all of them, but many of them, the first thing they want to try and do is experiment with alcohol because they've just been told over and over again, no, 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 not allowed, not allowed, not allowed. It's no different. And I think you're spot on. It's something psychological with that.
Yeah. So I want to go back into two things specifically that, you know, for people that are listening and watching, again, you have all these people in your ear constantly via social media or whatever platforms, and they're making everything else sound legitimate. They're making it sound scientific. So I want to dig more into calorie intake, and I also want to dig more into the resistance training, weight training, things like that. So to go back to the weight training, explain the science behind why you brought up weight training and not cardio.
So weight training is going to build muscle. And whether you're 18 or 80, male or female, if you increase muscle, you increase metabolism. So let's say, for example, you gain a theoretical 10 pounds of muscle mass. You theoretically, in doing so, will have increased your metabolism by over 300 calories per day. Now, first and foremost, I don't want, you know, like if you're a middle-aged female and you're listening to this and you're like, the last thing I need is 10 more pounds of muscle. I don't need to be big and bulky. You won't be. In my exaggerated example, when you think of a pound of muscle, think a baseball. When you think a pound of fat, think a basketball. So if you get rid of 10 basketballs and gain 10 baseballs, you're a hell of a lot physically smaller. So you will not get big and bulky. What you will do by gaining that 10 pounds of muscle is raise your metabolism by in excess of a theoretical 300 calories a day. So that's why weight training is so important. Mm-hmm. Cardio is not going to build muscle unless it's short duration, almost like the manner a track athlete would train. So short distance sprints, that is going to increase muscle size. Probably not as much as actual weight training for most people, but yes, that would work. But the typical cardio, the long duration, low intensity cardio, you're going to get a short-term increase in calories burned, but long-term, the more you do cardio, the less you'll get from it. Whereas the more your weight training, as long as there's progressive overload, as long as there's enough of a challenge for the body to respond to the challenge by adding a little bit more muscle mass, you'll continue to raise your metabolism. Mm-hmm. We look at cardio. So a year ago, I was working with a middle-aged male, wanted to do a bodybuilding contest, approximately 50 years age, drug-free. And I say drug-free in regards to performance-enhancing drugs. We'll leave that out of this. Individuals on performance-enhancing drugs, and what are those? Steroids, what most of you would recognize that as, steroids. Steroids give you a whole different playbook and a different set of rules. So we have about 50-year-old, middle-aged male, wants to do bodybuilding. And in bodybuilding, it's easy to look at pictures on a bodybuilding stage and look at yourself 8 or 10 weeks out and say, I don't look like that. Well, the person's photo you're looking at didn't look like that 8 or 10 weeks before the contest either. So the client at the time was concerned he didn't look like the pictures of people he saw on stage. And I said, you're not supposed to, you're not on stage. They didn't look like that either. And then I showed them photos of middle-aged male clients 8 to 10 weeks out. And I showed them their pictures on stage. And I'm like, they didn't either. And he started doing his own cardio, started walking, doing all this stuff. And I told him, I said, listen, like the more you do that cardio, the less you get out of it. What do I mean by that? We call it getting in better shape. So if you've not done anything and you've started exercising, in a couple of weeks, you're in better shape and you notice it, you're like, wow, I'm in better shape. That which was hard 3 weeks ago is now easier. Well, that's what we call getting in better shape. And as we get in better shape, we're getting more efficient. More efficient means we burn less calories. And the human body is built to survive. Like, no matter what we think, whether you believe in the good book or you believe in evolution, the human body has been evolving and changing for 2,000-3,000 years, if not the millennium, and it's built to survive. So it says, Kelsey is having me do more and more cardio, so I'll just get more and more efficient at it. It'll get easier for me to do the cardio. I'll spend less calories doing it. So that is why cardio, though it can be a tool for fat loss and it can be a tool for quality of life, long term, it's not the best tool for losing body fat. The number one tool is managing your calories. And the number two tool is weight training. Cardio is way behind those two.
So when it does come to weight training, like one thing that pops into my head right away, and I'm a almost 36-year-old female, so this is big in the circles that I run in. But of course I have friends that do things like yoga or bar classes. And I was curious about bar when it became really popular. I have a history of ballet and I was like, oh, that'd be fun. You know, I'll go try it out. And so I went to this class and there's no outside weights except for maybe like light ankle weights or something like that. And really it's just holding a lot. So it's lots of static holds. And of course you start shaking because of that. And one of the instructors came over to me during my very first bar class. And of course I'm shaking like everybody else is. And she says, oh, you're doing great. If you're shaking, that means that your muscle is growing. And of course I didn't tell her anything about my history or what I do. And I was like, okay. So how do you help people understand even things like that? Like, what does weight training mean? What's effective and what's not? How do they progress within a weight room even?
So if we look at like the bar, the yoga, or even the group training environments, the group training with weights is a good way to improve your health and wellness, and you will lose a little weight. It's not going to give you that really lean bathing suit body that you're thinking it's going to. The yoga, the Pilates, the yoga lattes, the bar, those are going to fall into the quality of life activities. That's no different than the firefighters for the city I mentioned going and playing basketball or volleyball at the Park District gym. That's a quality of life activity, but that's not working out. That's something, you know, that's the, even though I'm not 22 anymore, I'm 36. I can still go and be active in a group of people. I can incorporate some social component and be physically active. That's quality of life. If it worked really well, everybody doing those type programs would be shredded, look amazing in a bathing suit. And they don't. So, you know, show me the masses of people that have done that, that look amazing. Now, do not show me the owner who had been part of a dance company for 13 and a half years, who's danced in some major shows in Vegas or Broadway or the ballet, or don't show me that individual who's looked the way she does today since she was 17, right? Mm-hmm. Show me the individual that was overweight, unhappy with how they looked and felt, started doing that and looks remarkably different. You won't have that person to show me. And if you do, they'll be very few and far between, or what we statistically would call an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
Weight training, on the other hand, as you get stronger with weights, you add more weight. And the easiest way to do that is something called the double progressive. I use it with clients all the time, and it's this easy. Any exercise, free weight, dumbbell, kettlebell, doesn't matter. Any exercise. Let's say we're going to do 3 sets of 8 to 12 repetitions. You choose a weight. You can do at least 8 times on all 3 of the sets, and you work to get to 12. You keep the weight the same. When you get all 3 sets of 12 repetitions, you increase the weight like 5 pounds. And the goal is, let's say on set 1, day 1, you do 100 pounds. It doesn't matter the exercise. We're making this up. Don't get hung up on, well, I only weigh 110 pounds. How am I going to lift 100 pounds? Doesn't matter. Don't go there. So let's say you take 100 pounds, got to do it at least 8 times. Set 1, you do it 9 times. Set 2, you do it 8 times. Set 3, you do it 8 times. The next time you do that workout, set number 1, come hell or high water, you have to get at least 10. Set 2, you must get at least 9. Set 3, you must get at least 9. And in doing that, we just moved a tiny bit, slight bit forward versus our last workout. And we keep progressing that way until we get all 3 sets of 12, and then we just raise the weight and we start over. And that's going to work for most people for probably 1 month to 6 weeks. And then they'll plateau and they won't be able to move up in weight. Or let's say they're a middle-aged female, they weigh 130 pounds. They're going to get on some exercises to 20-pound dumbbells. They can't jump from the 20-pound dumbbells to 25s. It's too heavy. If you're in one of the rare gyms that has the in-between dumbbells where you can go from a 20-pound dumbbell to 22 and a half to a 25, you might get a little more time, but at some point you will plateau. When you plateau, just change the exercise. But the key is we're either doing 1 more rep per set or we're adding weight for all 3 sets. And that's where we get the continuous improvement. That's where we get the consistent in black and white. I know why I'm better than I was the last time I did the workout. And that overload, again, the body is built to survive. Back to evolution in the, or the good book, whatever book you believe in. It's either a few thousand years or millennia. The body's built to survive. If Kelsey keeps applying a greater load and stress to the body's going to say, build a bigger muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you build a bigger muscle, you raise your metabolism. And you raise your metabolism whether you're 18 or 80. And in regards to metabolism, pop culture would have you believe that as you get older, metabolism slows down. It does in North America, but it does only because we do less load-bearing activities. So yes, your metabolism at age 40 will be slower at age 30 if and only if you haven't done load-bearing activities for that decade. If you don't want your metabolism to slow down, lift weights. Why? Because the body will respond by increasing muscle mass, and more muscle means you burn more calories.
So is anyone born with, or do they, are they genetically predisposed to have a slow metabolism?
That's a good question. I would say I don't know the actual data on that. like the research, but anecdotally, I would say that 80% of us come from the factory awfully darn similar. And then there's going to be 20% in either direction. And we cut that 20% in half. That gives us 10% on each side of the 80%, which represents the masses. There's probably going to be 10% that it's like climbing a mountain to gain any weight. And then there's going to be 10% that struggle to lose any weight, or have always struggled with being quote unquote heavier, having a higher body fat percentage. But it's not going to be the overwhelming masses that suffer from being born with a slow metabolism. It's just not, it's not true. You're suffering because you overconsume and you undermove with the right movement activities, which would be weight training.
So perhaps more of a lifestyle, and even what I see in what's your standard, you know, like you have a very active family. There's a standard there of you move every day, you do something every day. So maybe it's, you start with the choices that you're making. You start with the lifestyle that you're mimicking, that maybe that's where genetics come into play. You know, mom and dad did this, mom did this. Where does that go?
Yeah, 100%. So I used to do a talk on exactly what you just said, like the genetics, the family. And yes, that plays a role. And I always used to use, and I'll use it here. I use old school multiplication tables, right? So let's say the number 3. 3 times 1 is 3. 3 times 2 is 6. 3 times 3 is 9. You get the idea. That number 3 represents your family. That's your genetics. That you can't control that. If you're a 3, you're a 3. It's just the way it is. You're a 3. Great. What you multiply that genetics time, your environment, your lifestyle is up to you. So you can multiply the 3 by 1, or you can multiply 3 by 30. You get to control the lifestyle component. And in doing so, you change how that 3 is expressed. So I remember, man, it's probably 20 years ago, I had a lady insisting that her mom was fat, her grandma is fat, the women in the family are fat, and she's fat too. And I said, no, I don't think it's the women in your family. Like, there's more to it. And I got her to talk about her lifestyle and her mom's lifestyle and her grandma's lifestyle. And she did things before bed, food-wise, that her mom did and her grandma did. And those food habits before, and you can eat right before bed. I put bodybuilders will go and eat 800 calories and go to bed, and they'll wake up shredded like an anatomy chart. But in this case, we have somebody that's already overweight, already undermoving, not doing weight training. Who knows what their daily caloric intake was? She certainly had no idea, but she was eating like sandwiches and milk before bed every night because that's just what mom did. Well, that's not a genetic thing. And grandma did it too. That's not genetics. That's nurture. You're doing what your mom does, and she's doing what her mom does. So now we have a pattern of behavior that's been shared across 3 generations that's contributing to the fact that all 3 of you are overweight. But you're not stuck. I mean, genetics, there are going to be some limits. But again, if you take a number 3 and you multiply it by 1, or you take a number 3 and you multiply it by 30, the 3 is going to be expressed differently.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I wanted to go back towards and have you explain more of the science behind it, because again, I think that this is where there's a lot of different information out there, and you in particular tend to get a lot of clients that have been battered and bruised by somebody else, and they've been in this calorie deficit, deprivation, take everything away, strip it all down. It's all no, no, no. Do you typically encourage your clients to eat more calories than they're used to, less calories, and why?
So my initial answer is yes to both. But starting out, many people don't even know what they're currently eating. Like they don't have an idea of how much food they're eating. So step one is, you know, we have to meet them where they are, and we have to know where they are. And right now they don't know where they are. So we got to establish that first. And to do that, typically I'll give them a target to hit in terms of calories, protein, carbs, and fat. And I'll have them consistently hit those targets for 1 to 2 weeks, and we'll see what we have. So we'll know where they are, and we'll have real data, and the data matters. It's not a guess. And then we'll adjust accordingly. So I can give you a couple real examples of what that might look like. So here's a mid-30s male, married, 3 kids. In September, so 3 months ago, he weighed 177 pounds. His initial calories were 1,950. Sitting here 3 months to the day later, okay, now buckle up, hold on. He's 167 pounds eating 2,500 calories. So in 3 months, we've increased his calories by 600 and he's lost 10 pounds.
And how does that work?
Well, in a lot of folks will argue, and I can give you example after example and an example after example of male and female middle-aged clients doing that. He's not a bodybuilder. He doesn't do this for a living. He has a full-time job. A lot of people, when I share that, and they've done this on social media, they've cried, what about thermodynamics? Well, here's the funny thing. I've sat not one, but two college 300-level courses in applied thermodynamics as a student pursuing a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. So I've actually taken not one, but two mechanical engineering courses in the field of thermodynamics. I'm well aware of what the law of conservation of energy says. And that law simply states that energy cannot be created nor destroyed. So how can you have an individual consume more energy, calories, and the scale goes down? Well, if that individual is able to do more work, they burn more calories. Remember what I said. Theoretically, every time you gain 10 pounds of muscle, you raise your metabolism by 300 plus calories per day. The amount of work you do with a small muscle compared to the amount of work you can do with a large muscle is a different amount of work. If you're doing more work, you're spending more calories, right? So that in large part is what is happening. And then along with that, you know, there ends up being an increased focus on the weight training. When I take somebody that is lifting weights in the gym, and that's what most people do, and I owned a large commercial gym where 250 people a day on average came through, most of them never looked any different. And even the ones that lifted weights, because they're just lifting weights. When you compare and contrast that with actually training with weights, it's a whole new animal. Like in your case, Kelsey, your husband's a strength coach for a large university. His athletes don't come in and lift weights. They come in and they train. So when you have somebody that's training with something like the double progressive, where there's a plan to be better from one workout to the next, and they're physically moving forward on a consistent basis, and they're gaining, and because of that, they're gaining muscle, well, their metabolism's going to go up, which means they can eat more food. Here's another one. Here, we'll because we don't want to leave the women out. Here's this middle-aged female, married, 3 kids. From February to July, we increased her calories by 950 calories per day. She lost 4 pounds. How? Consistently training with weights, consistently making better choices in the amount of food, not what foods we eat. And a lot of people get hung up on, well, I'm going to eat clean. Bullshit. There's nobody in North America eating dirty food. Show me the dirty food. It doesn't happen. Any food you eat is going to be clean, right? It's not clean eating. It's not overeating and undermoving. and it's increasing that muscle mass. And again, I can give you example after example of people that are doing that. Here's a male, 52 years of age. Let me grab his numbers. So November of last year, he was 174 pounds, eating 2,100 calories. September of this year, he was 159 pounds, eating 3,200 calories. 50 plus years of age. Okay, so we could do that all day, but it's working with the science, and the science is simple. It's if you have a car with a large V8 engine and you look at your fuel economy compared to if you have a Toyota Prius hybrid, the Prius hybrid is going to burn much less energy. So if we build more muscle mass, we're going to burn more calories. Mm-hmm. And then as body fat percentage goes down, insulin begins to be able to do a better job doing what it's supposed to do and not storing extra calories as fat.
Mm-hmm. So what happens to the person that has been in a caloric deficit for a long time and they've just continued to strip away and strip away and they stop seeing any change? What's happening there?
Again, the body's built to survive, and it becomes a question of economy. It's like saving money. Like, we may not have another paycheck coming in, so we need to cut expenses and we need to save, right? It's no different than your family budget. If you're an individual, your individual budget for the month. If you lose your job, you're going to be mindful of the money you have saved, and you're going to cut expenses. You're going to get rid of Netflix. You're going to get rid of, you know, that costly membership for another internet program so you can binge watch TV programs. You're going to get rid of, maybe you have auto ship a high-end premium mushroom coffee. That's going to go by the wayside. Instead of going to Starbucks, you're going to go to McDonald's and get the 99-cent coffee, right? You're going to try to save. Well, when you put the body in a constant caloric deficit, and we can do that by over-exercising or under-eating or both, the body is going to say, save, cut, cut, cut. Well, what are the expenses? The expenses are caloric expenditure. Remember what I told you about muscle. More muscle raises metabolism. Faster metabolism burns more calories. We have to cut expenses because we don't have a lot of calories coming in. We're in a deficit. So the body's response is to get rid of muscle mass, and in doing slow metabolism. That's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's what most people do. And if you look at, especially on the contest prep side of things, what are the two things most people do? They do a ton of cardio and they don't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to a point where they're looking worse, because they're losing muscle. Like, if you're not going to look defined if there's no muscle to see.
Mm-hmm.
So they start plateauing, they start losing muscle, they're not eating, things just keep slowing down, and it just snowballs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to fix that, you have to start eating more, and you have to trust the process. You have to be willing to stick with it.
Yeah. Stay in the boat, right?
Right.
So do you have a line that exists? You know, when people say, you know, quote unquote, you can eat anything you want as long as it's within your macros. Do you agree with that? Do you have a line where you feel like, no, we need to talk about nutrients, quality? Where do you exist on that spectrum?
Yeah, I have a line. It's called science, period. And the law of conservation energy most definitely applies. Unfortunately, the knuckleheads that throw the 4 or 5 syllable word thermodynamics have never sat in a classroom and thought about what that actually means, where if you build a larger engine, you burn more calories. But that's first and foremost. Like, when we look at long-term weight loss, weight management, it's going to be managing energy. And calories are both king and queen of managing your weight loss. It's going to come down to calories. I've had competitors get on the contest stage very lean, And they had chips, guac, and Corona Lights all the way through up to the contest. So first and foremost is total calories per unit of time. And the easiest unit of time to look at is per 24 hours. It doesn't, you know, yes, theoretically 4 to 6 small meals might be ideal. But what happens, for example, like we had 4 or 5 clients that worked in federal corrections. They worked like 12-hour shifts. They often worked overtime. And they had a little tiny like travel clear soap dish thing that you'd see at a campground. They could fit their food for the day. Otherwise, they had to eat in the cafeteria with the inmates. They couldn't eat 6 meals a day. It was impossible. So we structured the calories first, and they ate however many meals their schedule allowed, and they lost weight like the people that ate 6 times a day. But it's calories per 24 hours first. And then we get into where those calories come from, and that's going to be protein, carbs, and fat. Protein, for the most part, is going to be around, for a healthy individual, protein is going to be around 1 gram per pound body weight. It's going to stay there. Now, that number can go down when we're in a caloric surplus and we're eating a lot of food and the body is not having to use dietary protein to satisfy energy needs because we're too low on calories. But it's going to be around 1 gram per pound total body weight, not kilo per pound total body weight. Leave the kilos out of this. We're in North America. We don't use kilos. Fat's going to be probably 40 to 60 grams. For a middle-aged female, it'll be around 40 grams usually. For individuals that enjoy, let's say they're an omnivore, they enjoy food sources, animal proteins that come with fat. You get the protein and the fat. Maybe they like chicken legs and chicken thighs instead of chicken breasts. Like they just don't like chicken breast. We might move that 40 grams up to 50 to make a long enough runway so they can eat the foods they enjoy. Because again, back to what I said early on, it's got to be sustainable. If I'm telling you to eat food you don't like, you're not going to stick with it. So let's work with the things you already like. So fat's going to be in that like 40 to 60 gram, and carbs will be the rest.
Okay. So we've talked a lot about sustainability. And I think that one thing that's important to address is how you talk to people or coach people on things like birthdays and holidays, you know, those big, especially like Christmas, I feel like even gets extended out to, it's a 3-week weird period where you're at parties, you're at gatherings, you're going out to restaurants. How do you help people approach that time of year and still feel like they are succeeding and they're a normal person?
Right. That's a great question. At almost 50 years of age, my answer is radically different than when I started my training and coaching business 25 years ago. As I've gotten older, as I've acquired life experiences, I have a totally different perspective on that. And the perspective I have today is not everybody will be here for the next birthday. Not everybody will be here for the next holiday. Not everybody will be here for the next special event. Some special events are only going to happen once in a lifetime, so don't miss it. So enjoy yourself. Now, that being said, don't show up to the holiday event and overeat everything, right? If there's something that is specific to that holiday, that time of year, or that one family member that only makes that one thing that one time every year, we'll enjoy that and don't worry about it. Right? Like if they're serving a bunch of frozen pizzas, don't load up on the frozen pizzas. So enjoy the holiday and don't sweat it. Don't worry about it. Now, when you look at, you know, the Christmas, New Year's timeframe, or really Thanksgiving until January 2nd, there could be like a 5 or 6 week stretch where, depending on what your lot in life currently is, you could have business functions for the holidays. You can have corporate functions. You could have customer functions. You could have family functions. You could have Friendsgiving. And then pretty soon we could stretch this to pigging out for 6 weeks. I wouldn't do that. But again, if we're, the nice thing about calories and macros, and this is the reason I wrote my first book, Eat by Color, 21 years ago, was to teach people how to have a simple way to stay in their lane, not overeat or undereat, without stressing over what foods they eat, right? So, and at the time I wrote Eat by Color, macros were like, nobody was talking about macros. People didn't know what they were. Sure, you knew calories, but if you wanted to know how many calories were in food, you had to go to a bookstore, and hopefully it was a large enough bookstore that had a section on nutrition and exercise. And they would have books that were like 4, 5, 6 inches thick of like every food under the sun and calories per serving. Mm-hmm. So you had, like, you couldn't do that. Today, with your mobile device, your phone, your tablet, you can look up and see what's in pretty much everything. And in North America, their popular chain restaurants are required to disclose the calorie count, all this stuff. Because of that, you know what you're eating. Because of that, in the palm of your hand, let's say you're going to a dinner function and you know you're going to overeat for that one meal because it's your favorite food. Insert favorite food here. Well, earlier in the day, just scale back what you eat before you get there. Mm-hmm. Right. So let's say you're eating 2000 calories a day. Maybe you've only eaten 800 calories before you get to the dinner. That's 1200 left. And back to the sustainability and back to what's so important with your food, with building muscle, you know, let's take the example of the middle-aged male, 3 kids, in his 30s. 3 months ago, he was eating 1,950 calories. Today, he's eating 2,500. As we continue to move the caloric intake up and that individual's not getting fat, guess what happens? You get to around 3,200, 3,400 calories a day, and you can go to that dinner function and have whatever you want, and you still have like 2,000 calories left for the day. So it gets a lot easier to manage. But the shorter answer is I would enjoy the holidays. Don't eat things you don't really care for or like because it's a holiday. But if there's something you do like, have it and don't worry about it. Life will go on. And then don't think the next day you're going to do a ton of cardio like a magic eraser to wipe out those calories. It doesn't work that way. Just wake up the next day and get on with your life.
Mm-hmm. I think it's good for people to hear in general that it's not about perfection, that it's about making smart choices all the way across the board and not setting yourself up for failure in the first place. It goes back to sustainability too, right?
That's right. And nobody plays a game they can't win, mm-hmm. right? That I used to say that all the time to my staff in the club. No one's going to play a game they can't win. And if you set up the rules of the game to where you're going to lose, you're only going to lose so often before you say, forget it, I quit. And if one of those rules is perfection, you're only going to fail so many times before you say, forget it, this is impossible. And by the way, perfect is impossible. Perfect doesn't exist. Tying this back to the fire department again, I had a couple of firefighters that had asked about what you just said, trying to be perfect every day. And I said, listen, let's look at the big picture. Over the course of the next year, if you could have 320 good days, the other 45 days aren't going to matter. Mm-hmm. It's just not. And you do that over a year, 5 years, 10 years, it's not going to matter. Mm-hmm.
So will you give me, for people listening to this, you've made a phenomenal case for weight training, resistance training, really making sure that you're staying progressive. So help them understand what your broad standards are for someone that is looking to get into the weight room. They want to see those results. And how do you measure that? Like, how do you help someone gauge, are they doing enough? Because they could be in their home gym with 3 sets of dumbbells and not a lot of options for intensity, or they could be going to the gym and not really feeling like they're doing that much. Should they be burning a certain number of calories? Should they be spending a certain amount of time in the gym? How do you help them gauge, are you doing enough, and how much of that should you be doing?
So everything you just said could be turned into like a half dozen more podcasts, right? So we'll keep it. If you have three sets of dumbbells and you're just getting started at home, you'll be able to make that work for a little while, but at some point you're going to have to buy more equipment or join a gym. For women, the adjustable dumbbells, Bowflex, power blocks, all the knockoffs, 0 to 50 pounds is probably going to be good enough or almost good enough. For middle-aged adult males, you're going to need at minimum adjustable dumbbells, 0 to 90 pounds. That'll be a long-term thing. Or just go join a gym. Caloric expenditure, we don't want to go down the rabbit hole of chasing caloric expenditure. And one of the reasons for that is, if you're looking at how many calories you burned and you're getting it from a ring or a watch, so a wearable device, they're not the most accurate. You really need to have a chest strap device so that puts the sensor on your xiphoid process or your breastplate, right on your chest and wear it 24 hours, which you're not going to do. So let's just leave that out. There's a time and a place for that. That's a tool. I wear a heart rate device when I train. It's definitely a usable tool. But it like if we were going to define like what are the boundaries? What does it look like? Let me give you a case study. Female came into my gym 6 months on her own. She was in there 6, 7 days a week for over an hour. I had watched her coming in, realized she was like, I could tell she didn't look a damn bit different, and concerned I was going to lose a member when she finally didn't want to play a game she couldn't win anymore and quit and gave up. I went up, introduced myself, said, "Hey, anytime you want to chat about your goals and the best way to reach them, I'm the owner, happy to chat." So she took me up on that. I said, "What are you doing?" "Well, I joined Fitworks about 6 months ago. I come in 6 or 7 days a week." I said, "Yeah, I see you in here a lot. What are you doing?" She's like, "Oh, I do about an hour of cardio and then some machines and I go home." I said, "How's it working?" She's like, "Well, I lost 4 pounds." And I looked at her and said, "That sucks." And she's like, "What?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's not working for you. And you probably believe that it's not working." She's like, "Well, what works?" And I said, "Well, you got to hire a trainer." And that was the truth. Like, we need to get you some different programming. She's like, "How much is that?" And I told her, and she's like, "Oh, I don't know if I can." And I said, "Well, let me know. If not, I'll give you some ideas to do on your own. Follow back up with me." She did. So she came in, hired up one of our trainers for 3 months. She did so well that her parents and step parents, both parents had long been divorced, remarried, whatever. Everybody pitched in and for like Christmas bought her another 3 months. So now she got 6 months. So this is pretty cool. We got 6 months on her own. We got 6 months with us. 6 months on her own, 6 to 7 days a week, an hour of cardio, putts around on some machines. She lost 4 pounds. 6 months with us, 3 days a week for about 50 minutes, she lost 71 pounds. 71 pounds in 6 months. And it didn't eliminate entire food groups, didn't say you can only eat steak every time you eat. We didn't say you can only eat from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. There was no don't eat before bed, no don't eat after 6. It was a long-term, sustainable, maintainable approach to nutrition that allowed her to eat the food she liked. Training-wise, she did 15 minutes of interval cardio 3 days a week, and then she did another 20 to 35 minutes of weight training before that. Cardio never goes before weights. So she did, let's say, 45 minutes of weights, and then she did 15 minutes intervals 3 days a week. That's it. 71 pounds. So what does that mean? Well, that's one example that says if you spend about an hour 3 days a week, you're probably going to be doing far better than you currently are. That would be a great start. 40 minutes of weights and then maybe 20 minutes of interval cardio, or 10 minutes of interval cardio, some core work, some flexibility, call it a day.
So if someone is showing up to work with their trainer and the programming, or you could argue the lack thereof, isn't something that's necessarily mapped out. It's just the trainer saying, here's what we're doing today. And it looks different every day, and there's no progression. Is that going to work for people?
It's going to be better than nothing because at minimum, an average or below average coach or trainer is going to help clients make some progress, some, right? Simply because that client's going to do more than they would on their own. So again, like using the example that I just did from the gym, she lost 4 pounds by doing what she was doing. It was just a lot of wasted time. We cut her time invested exercising every week from like 7 hours down to less than 3 hours, and she lost 71 pounds in the same amount of time. So when you look at that client trainer and the trainer's just making shit up before they go in the gym for the day, it's better than nothing. The fact that the client spent money, the client's going to show up to the gym because they're paying for it. So they are going to get better results, but it's not going to be it's not going to be anywhere near the results that are possible.
Mm-hmm. So my next thing that I think it would be a disservice to not talk about, especially if we're gearing this towards middle-aged people, is Ozempic and similar drugs. And I would love to hear how you feel about them, when it's right, if it's right, and who are they meant for, and would you recommend it?
So that I don't think we have enough information to really speak intelligently about it yet. So what I'm going to share is my current opinion. In utter and complete transparency, this opinion is likely to change over the next 3 to 5 years as we see, you know, what's the outcome, what happens with all the, I mean, as of this morning, there is a shortage of those drugs that are designed for diabetes medications, and that shortage, that vacuum, that void is being filled by offshore manufacturers and consumers buying stuff over the internet, and who knows what they're buying. So the take home point here is my opinion is what I'm going to share. And in full transparency, my opinion is probably going to change. But my opinion sitting here today is, I'll give you an example. I have a neighbor that's in her 70s. She's overweight, needed a knee and a hip. They couldn't do the knee and the hip because she was so overweight. Terribly deconditioned, didn't, again, overconsume, undermove. And in her case, the right answer would be that would be a place to explore using one of those drugs to help her lose enough weight. So first and foremost, she can address the joints, because if we get the joints right, then we can do the right thing, which is get her to move more. You know, we can't do that if the joints are shot, and we can't address the joints if we're too heavy. So it's kind of like the chicken and the egg, right? You're stuck. So that would be a case where I think there's opportunity there. I think there's other opportunities with people that are having comorbidities that are related to their weight, and there's a reason they can't do anything about the weight. It might be a short-term thing. Now, beyond that, I think there's a lot of people that are taking those drugs because they don't want to address lifestyle in a way that works. You know, the number of people that argue with me about like I said, with the thermodynamic stuff, the number of comments I've had on social media about that, yet I have client after client after client after client where that's exactly what happens. They eat more food and they lose more weight. So if you've taken these short-term unsustainable approaches and failed repeatedly, those drugs look really attractive because guess what? They work. But what we don't know today, and I'm not big on big pharma. I don't trust big pharma at all. But what we really don't know is we really don't know what the long-term effects are. And the other thing is, I don't know that because we don't have the data yet, I don't think we really know what the effective way to take those drugs is, right? So like, how much do you take and how often? I don't think we know those things. And then the biggest thing is back to sustainability. Is this going to be something that helps me lose weight today? But if I want to keep the weight off tomorrow, I have to keep taking them. And I believe that's going to be the case, is like, if the weight loss is because of the drugs and you cease taking the drugs, I believe the weight's probably going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think there's opportunity there. I don't think it's going to be the end all be all. I do think, and this is assuming that any of the drug companies are going to be honest with the side effects and stuff. So I don't know, you know, how that's going to shake out, but I do think in the next 3 to 5 years, we'll know a lot more and we may find that it's something we shouldn't do. You know, that's like the arthritis drug, I believe Vioxx 20 some years ago. It was like the cat's meow for middle-aged people, especially runners whose knees were shot. They're like, I can go back to running 15 miles 4 or 5 days a week. I feel great. Mm-hmm. Except it was killing people. And they hid that. And they knew that they would eventually get caught. And they knew they were still going to make so much money that even if they paid out for the wrongdoing, they were still billions of dollars ahead. So it's hard to believe that we'll get an honest picture, at least from the government, at least from big pharma, but we'll know, like you'll start seeing, you know, I know somebody that took this and this happened. We'll start hearing those stories happen. So I, at this point in time, I don't know. And I do think there's certain places where it seems to make sense, but I don't think we know enough about how to properly use them just yet.
Mm-hmm. I continue to hope that maybe it starts to mimic more like gastric bypass surgery and things like that, where, you know, a friend of mine that did recently go through that, he had to attend a set number of, he had to make his way through a checklist before a surgeon was even willing to pursue that option. And it even started with things like meeting with a psychologist X amount of times, you know, things like that, and really addressing more about what's at the heart of what's happening and not just, you know, slapping a Band-Aid on things or giving them a tool that maybe they're not ready for or that they're not going to use the right way or it's not sustainable.
Well, and even that, I mean, and I don't know what the current data is, but I think there is a significant number of people that go through gastric bypass or similar that regress.
Yes.
And they regress because that checklist isn't enforced long term. Mm-hmm. And that's really, that's, you know, again, it goes back to sustainability. Yes. Like it this is a long-term play. So you have to take a long-term strategy. So mm-hmm. if that checklist works for the person to qualify for the procedure, that checklist should be made permanent post-surgical care. Like it can't be an option because we've proven that it can't be an option to even be considered for the procedure. So why is it an option post procedure?
Mm-hmm.
And that came up in conversation this past weekend with some of the changes with like the that will be coming with the FDA. And I think they're wonderful. I think there is going to be a spotlight shine on some of the stuff that's been done with big pharma and big food. And the person asks about like obesity. I'm like, we're not solving it. And the reason we're not going to solve it is just what you said. Like the issue is far deeper than just the physical piece. There's other things that need to be dealt with and that we need a vehicle to deal with them long term.
Yeah. So you've gone over a lot today and a lot of really incredible information, especially to get people started. So we'll finish on a positive note, but start me off with the top three things that you would want someone to avoid right now.
Like don't abuse cardio. Don't pick a workout program or an approach to training that you can't stick with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an example, all of the pop culture influencers on social media that push the, you got to be hard. You got to get up at 4 in the morning. You got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got to do this, got to do this. Well, those people haven't worked with thousands of people. Like just ball sport athletes alone, I've worked with over 1,000. The average everyday folks, I can't even tell you. Competitors, hundreds. And what I can tell you is if you are like, you just can't train at 4 in the morning because that means you get 3 hours of sleep a day, you're not going to be able to stick with it. So you have to pick something that complements your current place in life or you're not going to stick with it, right? And then the other thing is food is don't, you can't pick an approach that requires you to eliminate entire food groups or an approach that has you only eating. And I'm just making this up, and I understand that carnivore might have other options, but you can't pick an approach that has you only eating steak, because I assure you at some point you'll want chicken, or you'll want fish, or you'll want spaghetti or pizza, right? It's or bread or cereal or whatever.
Close.
So, or Portillo's, that's right.
So what are the three things then that you would want people to start doing today to start being successful?
You have to prioritize weight training. Like you just have to. Don't neglect your flexibility and mobility. You know, as an example, so like I said earlier, I used to own a large commercial gym. I'm lucky I have a really nice gym in my house. It's borderline a commercial gym. And one day my wife saw me on a balance beam in our gym. She's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm working on balance." She's like, "Why?" And I'm like, "Because if I don't spend time on these things, they get taken away." So don't neglect things like quality of life things, your mobility, your flexibility, your balance. Make that a priority. You know, I get on an endo board every time I train. I spend part of my workout on an endo board. Even if I'm literally changing songs on Pandora, I'm probably standing on the endo board. If I'm between sets and I'm reading text messages or checking email, I'm standing on an endo board. Add the balance beam. Do things like that. And then the other thing is, when you look at food, figure out how to make better food choices in line with your goals that allows you to enjoy the food you'll actually eat, right? Take, for example, I promote two bodybuilding contests a year, and one of them happened a couple weeks ago. There was a disproportionate number of competitors that were all eating some type of white fish and green vegetable, the most popular of which being tilapia and asparagus. And I actually commented, I'm like, "This is all internet stuff." And there's a group of these competitors saying, "Well, what do you mean?" I'm like, "You all are from like four or five different areas of the country. You have different coaches and trainers, yet you're all eating the same stuff," which is fine if you really want to eat tilapia and asparagus. But if you don't like asparagus and you hate fish, what are you doing? So figure out a way that you can enjoy the food you like that is in line with reaching and maintaining your goals, because it's definitely doable.
Mm-hmm. They're perfect. So how can people connect with you? What types of, do you only do in-person training? Do you do things remotely? And what does that look like if they want to pursue a conversation with you?
Everything is remote and virtual. If somebody really wants to, I no longer own a gym. If somebody really wants to, I'm in Northern Illinois. If somebody really wants to meet, I have a commercial gym that we can do that at. I have clients that own a gym, and I have the opportunity to do that. There'll be a link, whether you're hearing this as a podcast or you're watching this as a webcast or you're seeing clips of these videos in social media, there'll be a link in the comments below. There'll be a link in the description below. But there will be a way for you in one or two clicks to set up a time to chat with me if you are so inclined.
That's awesome. And how long have you worked with some clients? Are you 6 weeks and you're done? 6 months? 8 years? How long have we known each other? 10?
12 years. 12 years. It'll be 13 in January, February.
Oh my gosh.
So the time piece is interesting. What we saw in the gym with clients, and this is where like I have a really unique perspective, because I did own that large gym, and I didn't just have me working with people, but I had 6 to 8 of you guys working as coaches and trainers too. And we were able to serve so many people and learn from them. And what we saw there was selling personal training for 3 months. You get 12 workouts a month, each month for 3 months worked, but we were really just starting to build a habit, not a lifestyle. And I noticed that clients that stayed for 5 or 6 months, started to move from habit to lifestyle, and they started to cement things to that long-term sustainable. The contest prep side of things is interesting because when you're working with an athlete that wants to get on stage in front of hundreds of people in a small bathing suit, they're willing to execute with great consistency. And it gives you the perfect lab experiment if you have a compliant client. If you have a client that's doing what they say they're doing, it's like having the ultimate lab experiment because they're in a petri dish and you can see exactly what happens. Like if we add this, this happens. If we take this away, this happens. If we do this and this, we get this. And that's invaluable. But the thing that you also get to see, and I've got to see with my own clients, and then also I think we've had like over 3,000 competitors cross our stage. In my unofficial study of asking competitors that did well, how long they spent getting ready, interestingly enough, the average is 5 months. So when we look at what's worked best for most people, it's around 5 months. So that's what we do with clients today.
Okay.
And that's like most of what we do with clients is built around what I've seen work the best for the last 20 plus years. So it's not a guess. It's based off real people that have real jobs and real families and real adult over the age of 30 issues. You know, family members die, spouses die, kids get sick, divorce, injury, career change, unemployment, laid off, economic recession, right? Everything that we do is based off what's worked best for most people almost all the time.
Mm-hmm. And who is your perfect client right now? Who do you really want to be working with?
I can tell you statistically, they're middle-aged female, and most of them have an interest in getting on the competitive stage.
Mm-hmm.
The ideal client is one that is willing to do the work and ask a lot of questions. Like I tell all my clients, there's no bad questions. They all get my cell phone number because the more they ask, the better I can help them, the better the results. Selfishly, on the other side, the more they ask, the more I learn, because if I don't already know, I'm going to learn and I'm going to be better positioned to serve the next client down the road.
Mm-hmm. And with so many voices out there, so many different personalities and people to work with and ways to spend your money, why do most people that you work with choose to work with you?
I think I would have to go and read the testimonials that I have and see what the common thread is. But they usually, you know, part of that common thread I do know is because what I tell them is supported by data. It's not an opinion piece. It's not bro science. It's not something I've read on the internet. It's science. You know, it's things like the law of conservation energy. Like, you're not going to violate that no matter what anybody says. That's the way it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is, even when it comes to people saying there's no way she ate 950 calories more over 5 months and lost 4 pounds. There is. You know, if you're doing more work, you're spending more energy. If you build larger muscles that allow you to lift more weight, you're spending more energy.
So, Ray, is there anything else that you really want to talk about today? Any other closing remarks or an elevator speech for how people can get their life to a better place starting right now?
Yeah, I think it's as easy as we all need to move more and consume less. I mean, that's even I had met somebody a couple of years ago at a neighbor's house. It was a relative, and the gentleman was at the time in his 60s. And he said, well, you know, what do people need to do? And I said, John, it's easy. Push away from the table. He's like, what? And I'm like, it's serious. It's the biggest thing people can do is consume less. So that's the biggest thing. Move more, consume less.
Okay. And anything else that you really want people to know, you know, ways that they can more, maybe from a lifestyle standpoint, what does it take to get started? What can they do? What's the call to action today?
Just do something different. More of the same will get more of the same. You know, we covered ad nauseum that you have to lift weights. You don't need to spend hours in the gym. A lot of my clients lift weights for 25 to 40 minutes. That's it. And they're competitive in the physique sports world. So they're doing things at the top level of getting really lean, looking amazing in a bathing suit. And they're only spending 25, 40 minutes lifting weights. So just start. If you've got those three pairs of dumbbells at home, start there. Stick with the large multi-joint movements. What does that mean? Overhead press, a row, a squat, a hinge at the waist. It's four exercises. Doing those four exercises a few days a week is going to do far more than doing nothing. But just start. I mean, don't get lost. Don't get mired in the absolute best way to start. The most important thing is to start. Yeah, another example, I got invited to participate on a website as an expert in training and nutrition. I wasn't going to get paid for this, but they wanted me to be part of it. I'm like, sure, fine, maybe I'll get clients out of it down the road, whatever. And the biggest issue I was having, and I eventually said, I'm not doing this anymore, thanks, but no thanks, is before people got started, they were getting worried about the perfect way to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish. I'm like, look, just start. Like, let's not, you're saying, well, what about this diet? What about this? But this is supposed to work better for this. And at the time it was versions of what today is branded intermittent fasting. I'm like, you would be far better to define, just pick one of them and start, do something different.
Mm-hmm.
So pick something, get started. If you want to pick something that works, I told you, somebody lost over 70 pounds in 6 months, exercising about 3 hours a week. That's it. And still enjoying the food she liked. Don't make it harder than it needs to be, but get started.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's worth noting that one of your best attributes is that you bring science and a need to know the why behind everything into what you do and what you offer people. And that's at the foundation of what makes you, you. It's your engineer brain. It's your curiosity. It's the demand for real information, but it shouldn't be this way, but it's what makes you a unique professional in the field. And I've had the privilege of experiencing it. I've had the privilege of being coached by you and seeing firsthand the success that you can have when you have real tools and a real gauge on what's real and what's not. And you've done a fantastic job of outlining that for people today. And I hope it makes a big difference. So thank you.
Thanks, Kelsey. If you like our content, be sure to subscribe to our channel. Leave us a comment below. Also, be sure to check us out on your favorite podcast provider. See the links in the description below.